We're studying in the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy. Last time we'd gotten to the 13th verse, so we're ready to start with Deuteronomy 17, verse 14 tonight. This verse begins a new subject in the instruction that God is giving His people. He's been telling them about how they are to obey the sentence of the law and the judges. Now he talks about an interesting area, about Israel having a king. Verse 14, when thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. Now this verse anticipates the fact that they are going to want to set a king over them, although God never told them to do that, and at the time they had the king, decided that they wanted to have a king, there was a strong implication that it was not what God wanted for them to have. They had a system of judges, and this system of judges went for some 400 years before there was ever even any mention of a king. And then, when Samuel completed his reign as a judge, and he set his sons in his place, who were lesser judges than he was, the people demanded to have a king. Now, this passage is God's instructions concerning what he wants about the king, even though he didn't command the king, nor really didn't want them to have a king. He did allow them to have a king. So, I'd like to turn over to 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, and read about this circumstance of the people asking for a king and some of the things that are said. 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter. And it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel under Ramah. Now it seems that the elders had a just reason to want to change the system, because the judges Samuel had appointed, his two sons, were just not the quality judges they needed and wanted. These men took bribes, they turned aside after lucre, and perverted judgment. Now nobody would like to be ruled under that type of a situation. So they decided they wanted to have a king. And verse 5, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Now we get a hint here of another reason why they wanted a king. They wanted to be like the other nations. They wanted to have a king like the other nations had. And certainly there would be many advantages to having a king. In having a king, they would be able to have one unified earthly head that could more efficiently coordinate the affairs of government. These are reasons that man might use. They could be better able to make war and to maintain an army and to negotiate treaties and agreements with other nations round about them. And furthermore, it just gave them more of a feeling of prestige to have a king. Now, God really intended for his people to be judged by these judges and for him to be the king. But it didn't look like the other nations. And as a matter of fact, today in the church, we find that when we have a situation like the New Testament describes, where we all give mutual edification, we are more than one to speak at a time in an assembly on the first day of the week. We don't have any one that's known as the pastor or is known as the minister or the reverend. We find the world doesn't understand this. And if we were going to be like the world round about us, we'd have to set up one person to be the central head in our congregation to really be like the world round about us and for the world to understand us as a group of so-called Christians. But God's way is not understood by the world, and so consequently we do not want to make changes just for the sake of looking and being like the world. And it would seem like you'd have so much better coordination to have one person that's the overseer, the ruler, the pastor of all the affairs of the congregation. But God's way is not that way in the church, nor was it really originally in Israel. He intended to have these judges, and for 400 years they did well with judges. But now they wanted the king. So make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us, and Samuel prayed unto the Lord. Now, Samuel might have had some other ulterior motives for not wanting them to have a king, because it meant an end to the system of judges as he knew it and as he had participated in it. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Now God intended that he be the king and that he do the reigning. And so another king would be a kind of a competitor in some ways to God, and it was a reduction in to some extent of God's total reign over them. You know, today we have a king who is Jesus Christ, as he sits on the right hand of the Father, and he reigns over us. We look to this king today to be our supreme sole ruler. But it seems that God did permit them to have a king. And one of the reasons, it seems to me, that he permitted it is that he used this kingdom to act as a type of the kingdom of Christ, giving prophecy showing that Christ would be a descendant from the throne of David. And the scepter then would remain. Well, God says, they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so now they do also unto thee. God seems to say here, they've tended to do this ever since I brought them out of Egypt. They've tended to forsake me and go after other gods, and now they're doing the same thing to you, Samuel. Now therefore, hearken unto their voice. Howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. So God tells Samuel to protest this. You solemnly protest it. Do not go along with it as though it's something that's good or that you would like to have seen on. But you show them the manner of the king that will reign over them. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground and to reap his harvest and to make instruments of war and instruments of chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. And he will take the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. And you shall cry out in that day because your Lord, which they shall have chosen, because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us, and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. Now we turn over in the same book of Samuel, a couple of chapters, to 1 Samuel 10, verse 19, and I'd like to read a part of that verse. And ye have this day rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversaries and your tribulations, and ye have said unto him, nay, but set a king over us. So we get an idea now of the tone of this situation of having a king. God did not exactly endorse it or approve of it. But when the people demanded it and insisted upon it, God did allow it, but he told them they would have trouble. He told them what the king would do. He would centralize the power. He would would take their sons and their daughters and their goods and their vineyards and their possessions, and he then would use these for his own cause. Of course, we see a lot of these things today in our own central federal government. Federal government takes from us and use it for its own ends, and it owns a large percent of the land in this country and has a tremendous amount of buying power. Even though it may be deficit spending, the federal government seems to come first in the land. And the Lord warned them about that, but the people still wanted a king, and so he allowed it. So the interesting thing about this verse in our chapter, Deuteronomy 17, is that God made provision for this king. Verse 14, when thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. Now, God anticipated this, although it was 400 years before it happened. Not a word said about a king for 400 years from the people. God anticipated it. And this is proof in itself that God is a divine, all-knowing being, and that he does exist. So notice now some of the conditions. Verse 15, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. That was one of the primary basic requirements. The Lord was to choose the one who was to be the king. Now, this did not happen in all cases. We found all these stipulations that God laid down here, they were many times violated, and as a result, the people as a nation had to pay the dire consequences. But the Lord was to choose the one that would be the king. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. Now, the king had to be one from among thy brethren. He had to be a member of the nation. He had to be a member of the family of God to be qualified to be a king. They couldn't use a stranger who wasn't one that was a brother. And so God would keep the kingship then within the confines of the nation and of the family of God. Each king would be a person who would be one who would be a follower of the true God. They couldn't go out and get another king because he had more power. They couldn't make an alliance with another nation and let the prince come in or anything of that nature so that they could be in good light with another nation. They had to have the king come from among their own brethren. Now, this was not always practiced. In Hosea 8, 3 and 4, Hosea talks about some of this. Israel hath cast off the thing that is good. The enemy shall pursue him. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not. Of their silver and their gold have they made them idols, that they may be cut off, and so on. So that was one of the places that Israel did depart from God, was in the way the king was set up and the person that was chosen to be king. Now in verse 16, but he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to the end, that he should multiply horses. Now this thing of multiplying horses, it's an interesting phenomenon. It seems that the getting of horses was an act of reflecting power, and an act that had to do with pride and haughtiness. Here was a nation where everybody rode on donkeys and mules and asses. And so for the king then to start multiplying horses would set him and his servants so much higher than anyone else. And God did allow the king to ride horses and certain use of horses, but all the servants couldn't have horses. And he said he should not multiply horses. Now another thing about the horses is he would probably take an undue amount of trust in these horses to be able to defend his nation with, rather than trusting in God. In Psalms, the 20th chapter, verse 7, he says, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. So God intended for his nation then not to be a nation that had so much of an armamentarium built up that they could place total trust in strength and armament. But he intended for his nation to place their trust in him. And these lessons that we learn that God intended for that holy nation, the lesson we learned about that holy nation, are things that can apply to us today in many ways. Now, the nations we live in today are not holy nations. They are not nations after God. They're not to be compared, really, with the nation of Israel. But if we had a holy nation today, a nation that truly was a godly nation and a spiritually endorsed nation, then it should follow these principles. But you know, the great nations today, their cry is, let's build up armaments. Let's get so many armaments built up that the other nations will be afraid to attack us because they know we have such great firepower. And we'll be able to protect ourselves and defend our shores by having the greater and greater armaments. Now, that's not what God said for his people to do here. He said for him not to multiply horses. And Psalms 20 and 7 says, some trust in chariots and some trust in horses, but we're going to trust in God. Well, another thing about the horses here is, he says, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to the end that he should multiply horses. Horses came from Egypt, and he didn't want the people to go back to Egypt to have any commerce with Egypt and to be making a road going back and forth to Egypt because he was afraid they would pick up the idolatrous ways of Egypt. And to go to Egypt to get horses, which is something that really the people didn't need to have to trust in. For as much as the Lord has said unto you, you shall not henceforth return, or you shall henceforth return no more that way. He didn't want them to go back to Egypt. And so the king, this was a stipulation that the king should not do. Now these rules were not followed. Many of the kings violated these rules. But we know from this what God originally wanted for the kingdom way back before it had a king. 400 years before it had a king. Well, verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives to himself that his heart turn not away. Now we see that was violated. Even Solomon violated that. He had many wives. And these wives did turn his heart away from God. They had him building temples to idolatrous gods. And this was the beginning of the complete downfall of the nation of Israel. The kingdom split after Solomon because of the poor way that Solomon had conducted himself, and because his son was so wicked that he couldn't judge and reign righteously, and the kingdom divided. And then he says, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. Now this was violated by some. Even Solomon violated this. Shall not greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. The king wasn't to drain the people, the resources of the people, for his own personal wealth. That was not to happen. So these three things, the horses, which would have to do with pride and power, and have to do with commerce in Egypt, not to multiply wives to himself, because they would draw his heart away from God, and then he wasn't to multiply the wealth to himself. And this has to do with the pride of life, and the lust of the eyes, and the lust of the flesh, the things that were talked about in the New Testament. The king was not to do that. Verse 18, and it shall be, when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. Now, another stipulation for the king was that when he took the throne, he was to write out a copy of this law. Some people think that that's the book of Deuteronomy. Others think that it is the whole five books, first books of the Old Testament, Genesis through Deuteronomy. And although he might have had enough affluence to have had all the copies that he could have wanted, he wasn't to get them that way. He might have been able to have hired many secretaries to have made copies for him. He wasn't to get them that way. He was to write the copies. And he was to take it from the book or the scroll that the Levites had. They had a scroll that had this law in it. And so he was to get that scroll and copy it from that book or scroll that the Levites had. And remember, this was a requirement for the king. The king was to be a godly man. He was to know God's law. He was to be aware of God. He wasn't somebody that would say, we're going to separate the state from the church, because he was intimately involved in the church as well as the state. So you see, we don't have kingdoms today that are set up by God to be spiritual kingdoms and have a temporal earthly ruler over them. We don't have that today. But this king then was to do a thing that would be quite beneficial for all of us to do. Now, we are to some extent, we're priests and kings today. And there is no substitute for each one of us making a thorough study of God's Word. And there's no better way to do it than to sit down and write it out or make some kind of a memorization of it to know what each word is and to know the sequence of it and try to get some kind of sense out of it. And the king was to do this. Not only did he just write the law out, though, but he was to keep it with him. I remember from earliest times in grade school learning how to spell. The most efficient way that I learned to spell, and I got this from a teacher who made us do this, was to write each spelling word 10 times. We had 10 spelling words, wrote each one of them 10 times, and when you'd written all those 10 words, each one 10 times, you pretty well knew how to spell the word. So God says about his law, write the law out. Verse 19, and it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life. Now, it wasn't just enough to write the law out, but it was to be with him. And we carry our Bibles with us, you know, and we have a Bible at home and always a Bible not too far away. But it's not enough to just carry it with you. He says he's to read therein all the days of his life, never reaching a point where it was not appropriate to read in this law. All the days of his life. Now that applies to us too, you know. Never is there a time when we've reached the point where it's not appropriate for us to read in the book of the law. Read from God's Word. There's always something else there that we didn't get the last time. And when we uncover one layer of facts and truth, there's another layer right underneath it. I don't care how deep you dig, there's always another layer there waiting for us. We have to get it, but it's there waiting for us. And so this king, regardless of the power that he had, regardless of the wisdom that he had, regardless of how long he'd been working at his job, every day he was to read in this book all the days of his life. All the days of his life. When we stop and see what God really wanted in a king, then a king had to meet some pretty special qualifications. And notice the results of this. That he may learn to fear the Lord his God. That's the first result. Learn to fear the Lord his God. To really, truly fear the Lord is something we have to learn. We do not just acquire it by instinct, because the fear of the Lord is not just simply having a dread of God, but it's having a respect and a love and a loyalty for God. That's the true fear of the Lord. Proverbs says the fear of the Lord is to hate all evil. That's one way to look at the fear of the Lord. It's to have so much respect for God that we hate all evil. And so when we begin to let evil creep into our lives and we begin to grow lax and to lapse a little bit with our religion, then we have lost some of the fear of the Lord to let us do this. But this studying and reading and having the law is the way that we learn to fear the Lord our God. He says here about the king, the Lord his God. So this king was to have a fear of the Lord. Not only was he a ruler of the people, regardless of how much power he had, he also had a ruler over him. And he was to ever have this in his mind, that he had a ruler over him. Then the next thing, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them. Not only did he learn how to fear the Lord, but he was to keep all these words himself. He was a keeper of the law. To qualify as a king, you had to be a keeper of the law. The next thing, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren. Now this law was to keep him in line with his brother. His heart was not to be lifted up above his brother. 6 of the 10 commandments have to do with our relationship to our fellow mankind. And this was to keep him from being lifted up with pride, to be haughty. He's not to be lifted up above his brother. Now, you know, as the king, he was the most powerful one. But he was not more powerful than the total power of the nation. They really were where the power lied, or where the power lay. He as one individual was most powerful, but he was not more powerful than all the other individuals. So that he had to look out for their welfare, what was the best for them. And his heart be not lifted up above his brother. His mind, his thinking facilities would not think of himself as being above the others. Now, you know, that'd be very difficult to do, to be the king and have all the power and to not think of yourself as being higher than the other brethren. Look how easy it is for us today to think of ourselves as being higher than other people around about us. We see people that are maybe less fortunate. They are maybe more ignorant to some extent. They have poor circumstances. They have different standards, different mores, and we easily think of ourselves as being above them. But not even the king was to think of himself above his brother. And that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left. He was to follow the commandment, not turn aside from it, right hand or left. You know, people say, oh, you just gotten so narrow that you're going to fall over backwards. The king wasn't to turn to the right nor to the left. Follow the commandment right straight and strictly down the line. To the end that, now here, this would be the result of this, to the end of that he may prolong his days in his kingdom. Oh, if he did this, he'd have a long, profitable, fruitful reign. He'd be in the kingdom a long time. He and his children in the midst of Israel. His children would be the descendants and go right on down. Now that's the way God intended for the kingdom to be. And as we study and look at that, we can see some very, very great principles there. Well, let's now move on into the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy, beginning with the first verse. The priests, the Levites, and all the tribe of Levi,